ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
What happens when wills go wrong? Contested documents, undue influence, farming family fallouts, and the executors left to sort out the mess. Hi, Damien Carrick here. Over the next few weeks, the Law Report presents Over My Dead Body, a special series on wills and succession.
Mr. Chenery wrote his will on a frozen fish packet and a packet of Mr. Kipling's mince pies.
People who are a little bit unhinged have appointed senior politicians and public figures to be their executors, people who they've no connection with.
The difficulty with undue influence often is proving it. These things happen behind closed doors.
If you own property, if you own an asset, the general rule is you can do whatever you want in terms of who you leave it to. You don't have to be fair. You don't have to be equal.
Why did Granddad leave everything to just one of his children? The pair weren't even that close. And why did my favourite aunt leave everything to her carer? She only took on the role recently. Was this really their firm, clear intention or something else? What sorts of question marks can there be over how a will is made? Today on Over My Dead Body, we're exploring undue influence and fraud. And a note, this conversation does not represent or replace legal advice. James Diamond heads up the Elder Financial Abuse and Guardianship Disputes Team at Moores, a legal firm based in Melbourne. James, when it comes to wills, how big an issue are fraud and undue influence?
Well, the honest answer to that, Damien, is it's difficult to know. We only have a handful of fraud cases, and the bar for undue influence and proving it can be very, very high. The reality of many cases in Victoria, at least, and I'm sure it's similar across the country, is that only a handful make it to trial. Many settle beforehand. But whenever these cases come to court, they certainly tend to be very colourful, very juicy, very interesting.
You acted for the family of a Mr. Lionel Cox. Who is Lionel Cox and what happened to him?
Yeah, so Lionel was an elderly gentleman living in Fitzroy, not far from here.
In Inner Melbourne.
In Inner Melbourne, a good, relatively expensive suburb. And he's 91 years old. He never married. He didn't have any children. And his only surviving relatives when he died were cousins. He'd lived by himself. He had a good group of neighbours about him that kept an eye on him. And in 2015, they persuade him to go into respite care. And he tells the respite care when he goes in that he's just coming in for the cold months. Within a few days, he meets Abu Kumar, who's the nurse unit manager at Cambridge House. In fact, she meets him on the day, and within a few days, she's investigating options for him to do a will. She realises that he doesn't have family, he doesn't have a will, and he owns a property in Fitzroy. Within a few more days, she's put him in a taxi and they're off to his house to collect some cash from his house. And then shortly after that, she goes and buys a will kit for him, and within a matter of days, a will's prepared, which we later find out names her as the sole executor and beneficiary. She then persuades or pressures subordinate staff to witness that will.
So he dies in August 2015 from pneumonia. Where does that leave Ms. Abha Anuraha Kumar?
Well, I think initially she probably thought she was in the clear. She initially applies for and gets probate, and because he doesn't have any close family members, no one contests it. But soon his neighbours get wind of this and they raise their concerns, and she ultimately faces disciplinary proceedings by the Nursing and Midwifery Board.
Okay, so there are two legal processes which arise out of this case. Let's talk about this first one, which is an action taken by the Nursing and Midwifery Board against Ms. Kumar in the Victorian Civil and Administrative Tribunal. What happens?
Well, VCAT was very keen to emphasise that they weren't there to decide the validity of the will. In fact, she had probate. Probate had been granted and no one had challenged it. That wasn't their job. Their job was to look at her professional conduct. However, in the course of that hearing, there was a lot of evidence given about how this will came about, and some interesting things came out of it. One was that she'd been in the room when the will was signed and witnessed, and when it had been presented to the witnesses, it had been folded over so they couldn't see any details about what was in it. Another thing that came out is that the witnesses said they had been pressured. And in fact, one of the witnesses said they hadn't seen Lionel Cox sign the will at all. It had been presented to them after the fact.
So they'd signed as a witness after the fact?
They had borne false witness. They hadn't witnessed him sign anything. And of course, in order for a will to be valid, it needs to be signed by the will maker in the presence of two witnesses. So that was all very interesting. There was also evidence that although she hadn't kept contemporaneous file notes at the time, she'd made her way back into the facility while she was suspended and inserted some self-serving file notes.
And what ruling did this tribunal make as to Ms. Kumar's suitability to practice as a nurse?
Well, it was interesting. She contested the proceedings right up until the very end and then ultimately cancelled her registration. But they nonetheless disqualified her for 5 years from working in any sort of aged care facility. And they made some pretty scathing assessments of her. They said that she was not a witness at truth, and at times it seemed like she was literally making it up as she went. They said her conduct showed a deeply flawed character and a person who lacks trustworthiness and integrity. So she was banned for 5 years.
For professional misconduct.
For professional misconduct. The interesting thing was there was then a second hearing in which they had to determine who would pay the costs. And quite unusually, she was ordered to pay the regulator's costs, which doesn't happen very often in these sorts of proceedings. The stinger was that the tribunal then said that this matter needed to be referred to the Register of Probates. And that's how the dispute about the will gets going.
Okay, so there's a second legal action. Everything we've spoken about before is from the written reasons of the tribunal. There's then this second legal action, the revocation of probate. Who commenced that action and how did you get involved?
Well, initially state trustees filed an application for revocation of the grant of probate. And state trustees, as the government trustee in Victoria, has standing where there's no known beneficiaries. And in response to that, Ms. Kumar went out and actually managed to identify beneficiaries. And she basically said, well, if these people have a better interest than state trustees, then state trustees can't push this application forward any further. The court then required notice to be given to those identified beneficiaries who were Lionel's cousins. And through the course of that, one of them made their way to us and sought legal advice, and we then made an application to be substituted as the applicants for revocation.
So your client, I think Geoffrey Cox, one of Lionel's cousins, was the person who continued with the action to seek revocation of probate. What happened? And what was the argument of the state trustees and then your client? What was your argument in seeking revocation of the will?
Our argument was that this will had come about in the most suspicious circumstances you could possibly imagine. And that being the case, that meant the usual presumptions about validity based on the fact that Lionel had signed the will and that it had purportedly been witnessed, they all fell away. She needed to prove that the will was properly executed in accordance with what the law requires. She needed to prove that he had testamentary capacity. And we're talking about a frail, dying 92-year-old man here. She needed to prove that he knew and approved what was in the will. And of course, there had been this evidence that the whole thing was folded over when it was witnessed. So that was going to be a tough mountain for her to climb.
And we're talking here about the findings of the VCAT tribunal, and that's what we've been speaking to. Yep.
That's right. And so while I don't know what advice she got, I suspect that advice was that she had a very substantial onus to overcome. She needed to positively prove all of these things. And the big problem with her is, if I'm her lawyer, the witnesses hadn't come forward. The witnesses to the will were nowhere to be seen. There was no evidence filed from them. So ultimately, literally on the steps of the court, she settled and ultimately consented to probate being revoked, which meant the money came back to Lionel on behalf of the estate to distribute amongst the cousins.
What stands out for you about this dispute?
I think it's quite shocking and it drives home how vulnerable elderly people are when they're in our care. She took advantage of that, but we all need to rely on us having a system where people in their most vulnerable times are protected. And I think that weighed very heavily on VCAT and the Nursing and Midwifery Board when they made their findings. They made very strong findings because they understood the societal risk that this sort of conduct places or exposes us to.
Did you raise concerns about allegations of undue influence or fraud when you commenced this legal action or stepped into this legal action. Is that the right way of thinking about or framing the legal arguments?
The difficulty with undue influence often is proving it. These things happen behind closed doors. We don't know what she said to Lionel Cox. So the better argument for us, because of all of the suspicious circumstances, she needed to clear those suspicions, dispel them. And she wasn't going to be able to do it. And as to fraud, it's difficult to prove that. At least it was in this case.
There was also a very interesting case in the New South Wales Supreme Court last year, the case of Waters and Frank. Who was the testator, Dr. John Waters? And what was in his, I think, various wills? I think he had four wills over a number of years.
Yeah, well, I think he'd done many wills in the last couple of decades of his life. But I think what happened was his wife had died, had two daughters. And in 2006, he gets hit by a car in Sydney CBD, has head injuries, hip and pelvic injuries, and he never fully recovered. And his daughters step in to help him out. They help him sell the family home and downsize to a smaller unit. And then they hire a carer, Lavinia Willamant, as his carer around 2008. And over the course of the next number of years...
I think it's Ms. Lavinia Willamant Brown, is that right?
Yes. And over the next... From 2011 to 2019, there's four successive wills in which in 2009, before the carer is on the scene, the daughters are broadly favoured. And then from that point, the carer starts to feature in the will. 5% initially, and then over the course of four wills by 2019, it's up to 21%. And then he obviously dies, and the 2019 will, the carer gets 21% of, was initially admitted to probate, and one of the daughters then comes along and challenges that and alleges that there was undue influence in how that will came about. And the interesting thing about undue influence cases and why it can be really difficult to prove sometimes is that it essentially needs the party alleging it to demonstrate that there was coercion, that the person felt like they had no option, that they had the literal gun to their head. So it's a high bar to meet in wills cases, and there's really only been a handful of cases in Australia where it's got up. But in this one, it did.
And in this case, it's not about necessarily proving that it happened. It's about refuting the suspicion, and that onus is on the person who's relying on the will. Is that right?
That can be the case. If suspicious circumstances about how the will came about are proved, in this one there was a direct finding of undue influence, and it wasn't one particular moment or instance of undue influence or coercion. It was a pattern of cumulative behaviour over a number of years, and the court referred to Dr. Waters being vulnerable and his cognitive decline and impairment, that he was dependent on the carer for many aspects of his daily life. She had been involved in a great deal of his legal and financial affairs and had actually been present when the instructions for every will had been given. They all were sufficient for the court to conclude that given his reliance on her and all of those other factors, Dr. Waters probably felt like he didn't have much choice but to sign the wills benefiting her.
And that was the finding of the Supreme Court of New South Wales. Look, there are a number of ways to challenge a will. There's lack of capacity, there's undue influence, there are technical defects in the execution of the will. There's another ground, fraudulent calumny. What is that?
Fraudulent calumny, if I'm perfectly honest with you, Damien, is a ground of objection even I was unaware of 18 months ago. It's rarely featured in Australian cases. I couldn't find a single instance in which an allegation of fraudulent calumny has gone to trial. But what it essentially involves is an allegation that someone has poisoned a willmaker's mind for the purposes of getting a benefit or depriving someone else of taking a benefit under a will.
And then them getting the benefit.
And them getting the benefit, or at least stopping someone else from getting it.
Okay, so 18 months ago you knew nothing about this, but you are now involved in ongoing litigation where this idea of fraudulent calumny will be argued. The Victorian Supreme Court has ruled that you can put those arguments to the court when the case goes to a full trial. There have been cases in the UK where fraudulent calumny has been successfully argued. One of them is a very interesting case called Whittle and Whittle.
Yeah, so Whittle and Whittle was one of the cases we had referred to and I took great interest in reading as our case progressed. But in Whittle and Whittle, there was Gerald Whittle, who was 92 years old and he was dying, and he leaves everything almost everything to his daughter Sonia, and he leaves his son David out. You know, David's only given some cars and some shed contents, and he tells the solicitor firm that prepares his will that they're basically estranged, and turns out that wasn't true. David had been visiting him weekly. It turns out Sonia had been telling Gerald that David was a violent criminal who had assaulted women and stole from his family, and he'd repeated it to Gerald in his presence. So Gerald turned around and accused David of this, or wanted to know if all of these things were true. And then I think in due course the solicitor's clerk comes to his house to take his instructions for the will, and I think the solicitor's clerk records that Sonia, you know, just about has a breakdown, making various allegations against David.
The solicitor's clerk said she had heard Sonia tell her father that David and his wife are criminals and psychopaths, and Sonia said that they had broken into his house while he was in hospital looking for bank account details and PIN numbers.
Yeah, that's right. So these cases are really interesting because it's not in contest that the will maker has actually signed the will. It's not necessarily in contest that they didn't understand anything about what was in the will, but it is accepted that they've made the will based on a lie.
So the judge found in this case that probate should be revoked because of this idea of fraudulent calumny, poisoning of the mind.
Yeah, and I think poisoning of the mind is a much better way to think of it than fraudulent calumny, which sounds like an archaic legal term.
You're listening to The Law Report on Radio National, and a special series focusing on wills. Today we're focusing on undue influence and fraud, and this idea of fraudulent calumny as well. And my guest is James Diamond, who heads up the Elder Financial Abuse and Guardianship Disputes Team at a Melbourne law firm called Moores. James, have there been cases where a court has said, we actually accept that this will has been forged? There was an interesting case recently in Victoria in 2022 involving the estate of a Mr. Frank Cassar. Who was he, and what were the circumstances around his will?
So this case is wild. Frank Cassar was a well-known, self-made man with a business based in Fitzroy. Initially, he was a panel beater. He got into tow trucks, and from there he built basically a property empire. Amongst his assets was basically a whole block of property in Fitzroy, which is, again, good real estate in Fitzroy.
Fitzroy is featuring a few times.
Fitzroy has lots of tales from Fitzroy. But an issue he had was that a lot of the property acquisition had been funded from lending from second and third tier lenders at very high interest rates. So it seemed like Frank had issues with pretty much everyone. The ATO were chasing him. They said he owed $2.4 million. At one point in time, The Age dubs him Australia's worst landlord over accusations that he's threatening and intimidating tenants and various breaches of residential tenancy laws. He's got a wife, Sandra, and they've been together for over 30 years, and they've got four kids. The eldest son's Michael. Apparently, he's been estranged from Frank for many years, but some reapproachments slightly before Frank's death. And then there are three other kids. Frank dies suddenly from a heart attack in 2011, aged only 60. And initially his wife, Sandra, tells a lawyer that they're looking for the will. She's certain that Frank did a will, and they're certain they will find it. And then a number of weeks later, the will turns up. And as it turns out, the will appoints Michael as the executor and sole beneficiary. It doesn't leave anything to Sandra. It doesn't leave anything to the other three children. And probate is granted in 2012. So the years go by. Michael...
A number of years go by. We're moving fast forward to 2019. What happens
and
then?
And a question you would have before 2019 is, if everything is going to Michael, why didn't Sandra do anything to claim something from this estate? She doesn't. Michael apparently sorts out the issues the estate has with its lenders, its creditors, with the ATO. And then some years later, there is disharmony in the family that assets haven't been distributed that it appears they understood would be distributed despite what the will says. Sandra confronts Michael about all of this, and Michael threatens to evict her. He tells her that she's going to be out on the street for her, quote, dog shit attitude, and then actually commences legal proceedings to get her out of a property that's owned by the estate. Sandra then applies to revoke probate, and remarkably, she admits that she's been involved in forging the will all along. Sandra's daughter Teresa also comes forward and admits that she was the one that forged the signature. She traced it out over legitimate signatures of Frank's. So this is bombshell stuff. Sandra says that after Frank died, Michael was pressuring her to organise something in terms of will or we're going to lose everything. Sandra says she went and bought a $20 newsagent will kit and she prepared it, naming Michael as the executor and the beneficiary because Michael had a good credit rating and he'd promised to share everything out later. She said she didn't sign the signature herself because she had arthritis and so she didn't think she'd get a very good job. And Teresa said, well, Michael pressured her into tracing out the signature. And there's a very comical scene in the judgment in which Teresa is supposedly forging the signature and Sandra is yelling out at her, don't stuff it up, I had to pay $20 for that will kit and I don't want to have to go back and buy another one. So it's interesting. The witnesses to the will were Frank's two brothers, so Michael and Raymond. And initially, they both sign affidavits as part of this proceeding saying they saw Frank sign this will. He did it and they were there. But as the case goes on, Michael recants, having first said that he saw Frank sign the will in 2009, he actually later admits that he'd witnessed the will a month after Frank died at his own kitchen table. Interestingly, the other brother, Raymond, sticks to his story that he saw Frank sign the thing in 2009, but the judge ultimately finds that he's unreliable. There's also dueling opinions from handwriting experts. Michael's got a handwriting expert that says that essentially the signature looks legitimate, and Sandra has her own handwriting expert that said it doesn't. And the clincher is ultimately the vertical F in Frank, which appeared in none of Frank's genuine signatures. So the legal decision didn't need to be a decision about whether or not this will was fraud, like the Lionel Cox case. One of the arguments that this will had come about in such suspicious circumstances that Michael really had to clear away those suspicions. And the judge said that he'd failed to do that entirely. However, the judge went further and made a decision anyway, and he found that the will was an outright forgery. He accepted that Frank's signature had been traced by Teresa, 2 to 3 weeks after death. And he acknowledged the irony of accepting the evidence of someone who had come to court describing herself as a confessed forger. He said that Sandra was a person who, if her family's interest demanded it, is willing to forge a will and lie to solicitors. Yet Michael had said this is not a normal family and he agreed with that. And he therefore found that Teresa, Sandra and Michael Sr. were witnesses of truth and Michael was not.
And so the judge of the Supreme Court of Victoria revoked the probate and therefore Sandra, who admitted to being party to a forgery, became the main beneficiary.
Not only that, the properties had to come back. Sandra would have been entitled to get a grant of probate and I presume, I don't know whether he had a previous will, but I presume his estate would have then been divided on the basis of the intestacy laws that then applied, which probably would have resulted in Sandra administering the estate, but the kids and Sandra sharing in the estate. But there's then a second judgment about the costs and who should have to pay the costs. And I think that's quite remarkable. Sandra, having come forward to the court and acknowledged that she'd been party to this forgery conspiracy, Michael was actually ordered to pay all of her costs on the most punitive indemnity basis.
And we're talking hundreds of thousands of dollars, presumably.
Well, I would have imagined that'd be huge.
It's an extraordinary tale. James, you've been telling us a number of extraordinary tales. Up until this point, we have been talking about decisions where a civil court may have found that there was undue influence or fraud or something else and then revoked probate. But we must be clear, we can't say that any of the people involved in any of these cases have done anything illegal or criminal because we're not talking about a criminal prosecution. We're not talking about criminal prosecutions or criminal trials. But very, very, very rarely there are criminal prosecutions. In the UK recently, three people were jailed for fraud and forgery relating to a will. Who is 46-year-old Lee Voysey?
Well, Lee Voysey was a student of Maureen Rennie, who was the former headmistress and owner of the Barnes School in Hertfordshire. Voysey had been a student more than 30 years earlier and really had only re-entered Miss Rennie's life shortly before she died. Police said that she'd essentially befriended Miss Rennie shortly before she died, and then after she died, forged her will. So Miss Rennie dies, Voicey comes up with this will that makes her the sole beneficiary of Rennie's estate, which is worth about £4 million, so it's a big estate. And it includes the school and the land on which this school was located. After she produces this will, Miss Rennie's family members become very suspicious and they report the matter to police because they don't think the will is genuine. Two friends of Voicey are witnesses to this will. And in 2024, and we don't get many examples of this, but in 2024, Voicey pleads guilty to fraud and forgery. And the two witnesses also admit to the forgery offences, and all three end up getting jailed. So Herefordshire police describe it as an opportunistic attempt to steal the family's inheritance. And the judge says it had resulted in lengthy civil proceedings and enormous distress for the real beneficiary. So it's a rare example of fraudulent or very suspect conduct in these sorts of matters actually resulting in real jail time, which isn't common.
And James, I guess it's hard at this distance to know what the evidence was which gave the prosecutors the confidence to proceed with a criminal prosecution. But I have read in the press reports that Ms. Rennie's regular carers said that the new will was written or dated 2 months after Ms. Rennie had suffered a devastating stroke, and according to her regular carers had been talking, since that stroke had been talking gibberish. So that's at least one of the press reports talking about what the evidence was. James, this has been a fascinating discussion. What would be your advice to people when they are drafting a will?
Well, first do one. A lot of these issues come about because people don't give it a lot of thought, or they put it off, or they rush it, or they cut corners. I mean, this transaction you do when you die is the biggest transaction you'll ever do in your life. You're literally giving away everything you've got and everything you've ever worked for. And yet, people don't want to spend money on wills. They use will kits. They put it off. And so really, you know, get it done and have an unremarkable will that's done properly and sails through probate and avoids anyone needing to go to court for years and spending heaps of money on the fight.
So do it properly. That's the take-home message.
Do it properly and update it when you need to update it, when your life circumstances change.
And of course, this is not legal advice, but it's something to keep in mind. James Diamond, who heads up the Elder Financial Abuse and Guardianship Disputes team at Moores, which is a legal firm in Melbourne. Thank you. Thank you for speaking to the Law Report.
Damien, thanks for having me.
Next time, what happens when a will is unconventional? It might be scribbled on the back of a frozen food packet or jotted down in an unsent text.
Could it still be regarded as his final disposition? Did he really mean that document without anything else to happen to operate as his will?
That's on the next episode of Over My Dead Body, a four-part series on The Law Report. Do follow The Law Report on ABC Listen. That way you'll get the latest podcast as soon as it becomes available. It's also where you'll find the full series of Over My Dead Body and where you can follow Radio National's weekly fix of legal news. We look at the big cases like the Corey Richens poisoning case. Is she America's Erin Patterson? Why was Australian soldier Ben Robert Smith granted bail on war crimes charges? And we also delve into cutting-edge legal issues like facial recognition, voluntary assisted dying, who's liable for a bushfire, and what sorts of laws do we need to tackle cults? A big thanks to producer Christina Kukolia and audio producer Elise Simons. I'm Damien Carrick. Talk soon.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.